Hello and welcome to this episode of The Broadcast. My name is David Brooks, Head of Policy here at Broadstone, and I'm joined by two of my colleagues yet again to talk you through a pertinent issue of the day. We're looking at trustee secretarial work again. So, of course, I'm joined by Catherine Fenton and Chris McCarthy, who are both senior consultants at Broadstone. So, hello to you guys.
Hi, Dave.
They both nodded. For everybody listening, as this is a podcast, they both nodded. I'm not quite sure when they did that. I'll have to remind them that this is not visual necessarily. Anyway, so today we're going to talk about trustee knowledge understanding and give you some hints and tips of the ways that as trustees you can make sure that you keep everything up to date as you should. But I suppose first, Catherine, I'm going to come to you first just to give us sort of a basis of understanding of what is trustee knowledge understanding. What's the regulator's expectations for trustees in this area?
Well, so clearly, if you're going to run a pension scheme effectively, you need to have a certain level of knowledge of pensions matters, which is obviously the case. And the regulator has set out a list of topics in its general code of practice, which the trustees should have an understanding of. So that's your first port of call. And some of those topics are things like the law relating to pensions and trusts, investment principles, risk management, those sorts of things. But also you're expected to have a working knowledge of your own scheme, of course. So your own scheme's benefit structure, how the assets are invested, an understanding of the funding basis, contributions due, and that sort of thing. The most important point first to say is the regulator doesn't expect you to be an expert. It's absolutely fine that you're relying on your advisors for advice and you're delegating some of the functions of the scheme to other providers. But obviously you do need to have a certain level of knowledge so that you can properly understand how the scheme is running. For a new trustee, the regulator expects that they are going to undertake training and get up to speed within 6 months of their appointment. So that's quite quickly, I think, that they're expecting you to get up to speed. And for all trustees, no matter how long you've been a trustee, you should be reviewing your training needs at least on an annual basis. And I think that reflects that, you know, things don't stand still. There's always new legislation. There's always new requirements. So even if you feel like you've done the bulk of your initial training, there's always going to be new things that you need to get up to speed with. Or it might be the circumstances of your scheme have just changed. You know, you might have an employer who's maybe in distress. You might have, a very, very big change in your scheme. It's going through a buy-in or something of that nature. So as the scheme evolves, your knowledge also needs to change and keep up. So it's sort of an ongoing review of what you need to know and understand. And as the very basic minimum level, you need to go through the regulator's toolkit, which is the online learning course that they provide. And that's really helpful to give you a really good foundation of learning. You can do it whenever it fits in with your day to day, and it tracks your progress as you go along. So it's really helpful as a first element of your training. The regulator expects you to also have a training plan, ideally. So that means that you're looking ahead as trustees and looking what's coming for the scheme. You know, is there a valuation coming up? Are you going to be going into a buy-in, something new that you need some training on? And then you can plan that training at an appropriate time. Or it might be that maybe you've got a really long-standing, knowledgeable trustee who's going to be stepping down. You're going to lose their knowledge at that point. So maybe you need to plan ahead for that. And maybe the other trustees need to get a bit more training so that they can take over that role. And the other best practice thing is to keep all of this recorded. So have a training log, make sure that every bit of training you all do is recorded in there. And that helps you to demonstrate that you're complying with all of these requirements. And the last thing I'd say on this is the regulator now views knowledge as collective. So it's the whole trustee board's knowledge that you're taking into account. Not each individual trustee has to be strong in every area. And that recognises that every trustee brings something different to the table, different backgrounds, different strengths and knowledge. So as long as collectively as a whole, you've got that good level of knowledge, then that's acceptable.
I think that was quite a good easement or perceived easement from the regulator in the general code of practice. Because previously, trustees were expected to be experts at everything, which is never going to happen, to be honest.
No, there's too much. I mean, that's why there are people like us, I suppose, sitting around the table. I suppose one of the challenges that you get with that is, and what the regulator would like, is the ability to be able to question your advisors. So you need to have the knowledge enough to understand what they're talking about, to be able to question their advice, and challenge it if necessary as well, to make sure you're getting the best advice and making the right decisions. End of the day, all this is about making the right decisions, in the right way with the right information and all the rest of it. So Catherine, in your summary there at the beginning, there's quite a lot to go. I was scribbling little bits and bobs down, but I suppose that one of the initial bits is like keeping up to speed. You kind of noted in a couple of places, that keeping up to speed and understanding and planning and knowing what's happening, knowing what's relevant for you. What do you find with your board is a good way of sort of looking ahead to those developments, but then assessing or understanding what skills you have and how they might need to be filled, based on those sort of two parameters?
Yeah, so keeping up to date, I mean, I think things have moved on really well now, but there's so much more accessible training, really flexible training now. There are things like these podcasts, you can subscribe to things like that that keep you up to date, even if it's just small, short updates. Things like that can really help. And gone are the days, I think, of when you had a 2-day in-person training course and you all sat in an office for 2 days and it was quite intense. Now I think things are so much easier for trustees to pick up and to work around their day-to-day lives and fit them in. And one of the best ways, I think, to make sure that you're making the best use of your time for training is doing a self-assessment as a group, which usually takes the form of some sort of questionnaire where it lists all the training topics and each trustee will go through and score their knowledge on all of those topics. And that helps you to see if there's areas of weakness in the knowledge, either individually or as a group, and then you can set training sessions for those topics to fill in the gaps. And I think that's also useful as a benchmark because you can see how you've developed over time. If you do those periodically, you can see how the group have learned more and developed. It's not a perfect tool because obviously it's a bit subjective because you're scoring yourself, but it's probably a good starting point, I think, for most groups to start looking at what they can do more and how they can fill those gaps in.
And I think there's this kind of almost secondary learnings in there as well. And Catherine, you've already mentioned it about seeing what's coming with the scheme. So you're looking at all your other governance as well. You're looking at your business plan, looking at your risk register to say, okay, well, blimey, we haven't done that in a while. Don't tick that on the training questionnaire. And now we can create our training plan out of all those other documents. I think it's a good way to bring a lot of that governance together without trustees actually realizing that's what they're doing.
Yeah, I think what's worked well for me a little bit on some of my clients is asking the advisors to try to at least give their feedback as well, because you get training sessions throughout the year, or you get a view on how trustees are picking up issues. Because like you hinted at, Catherine, self-reporting things, some people don't necessarily want to admit they don't know something. It's You can do them anonymized to an extent, but then sometimes you do want to know who's got the strengths and weaknesses, so where your collective knowledge sits and who should sit on the subcommittee and the rest of it. So the anonymization doesn't always work that well. So a bit of professional judgment, and I think maybe the chair needs to be that person. We haven't mentioned the chair yet today, but I think the chair has that focal point. They're meant to have a bit more knowledge and understanding than everybody else, and so perhaps they would use their skills to sort of identify where trustees perhaps need a bit more support. In addition to the self-assessment and that ongoing and tracking. Just trying to think of other tips for keeping on top of that training and that training log. Chris, have you got any other tips for us on that?
Well, I think most advisors these days will issue regular updates. Make sure you're signed up to those, whether it's your administrators or your consultants or your legal advisors. There's always good bits and pieces. It's not all relevant, and try and pick out the bits that are relevant to your scheme. You might find other bits interesting, but if you concentrate on the bits that are relevant to your scheme, you're probably going to learn more, because you can put them into practice. And then, just even some of the national press, not always, but some of the national press will have stories that are relevant, and ask questions. Use those as the basis of questions to ask your advisors. And then you can get a response from your advisors, which is hopefully specific to your scheme and how things work for your scheme.
Yeah, no, I agree. I've done that. I've had clients do that to me, saying, is this relevant for us? I've read this about, I don't want to make a topic up in case it turns into a can of worms, but I've read this. Does this mean anything for our scheme? Yes, no. If yes, let's do something. If no, fine. Let's move on, and let's talk about something else. It's having that suppose that relationship with your advisors as well to be able to do that, knowing they're not going to go, oh yes, and do a nice big long training session about something you don't really need to know about. So have confidence that they're not going to upsell you something. But also, you know, I my position as the headmaster of the Broadstone Academy, you know, there are, you know, topical things will come along. Actually, we talked about the toolkit as well earlier, that the academy mirrors that, and I do keep reading that the regulator is going to review the toolkit at some point, but the world has changed. A lot of those toolkit modules, I think, other than the scams one, perhaps the DC one, I think all the other ones probably are as they were nearly 20 years ago, let's say, possibly 19, 18 years ago. And that's probably not the best place for them to be. They probably could do a bit of a refresh and update for anything to cover off all the general code stuff and then lots of investment things. So just to ask you two, have you heard any rumors about when that's going to happen?
Nothing more than you.
No insight.
My assumption was it would wait for once the general code was in, but it's been in for over a year now. So
yeah. There always needs to be something else, doesn't there? I mean, the regulator's so busy talking about other things. Okay, so Catherine, I'm going to go back to one of your other points that when you were giving us that intro at the beginning, around sort of that being conversant with your documentation. So can you just expand on that? What do you need to know? What do trustees need to know? What do they need to have at their fingertips?
So yeah, there's the knowledge on the one hand, and then the other bit is conversant with your own scheme. And I think there's two points to that. One is access to documents. So can you easily get access to all of the documents to do with your scheme? I'm not just talking about trustees and rules, but everything, member communications, booklets, funding statements, all sorts of things. And I think most schemes will now have a website or a platform of some kind where they've got this library of documents built up and they can easily access it whenever they need to. So I think that is, a big tick usually for most trustees. And the second part is the familiarity. So you're not expected to know everything, but do you know the basics of your benefit structure? You know, the sort of level that would be in your members booklet. Do you understand what contributions are due and when they're due? Do you have a broad understanding of how the assets are invested, why they're invested in that way, and the administration? Do you understand how that works? Who's running the pension payroll? Who's in charge of the banking? All of those things I think you can get familiar with if you've got the right stewardship reporting coming through, because that gives you the oversight of what's going on day to day. So if you're not getting those, you know, ask your administrator for a quarterly report, or ask your investment advisor for a monitoring report. And that would help you with all of that, keeping familiar with what's going on.
Again, I'd say that again brings in all the other aspects of governance, and Dave, you were mentioning it earlier as well about service providers and keeping on top of them, and that brings in your management of service providers. It brings in your oversight of administrators and making sure that you are aware, you have the knowledge to be able to say, well, actually, we don't get enough here, or actually, everything we get is great. That's almost knowledge that you can't necessarily write down in a code of practice, but it's what you need to know.
Yeah, it's interesting the way you guys are talking. It does feel so much more than doing the toolkit. You know, it's more than just you know, so it's in regulations. You need to be, you know, you need to have this TKU. It's in the Pensions Act 2004, or whatever. You know, it's there. You need to have it. But it's so much more than, you know, like you said, Catherine, attending an all-day conference from a provider about, you know, a beginner's guide to a trustee, and then going, well, I've done that, big tick, off I go. You know, I can be a trustee now. There is so much more around the running of your scheme and effectively acting as a trustee and working properly, you know, and knowing that, okay, we work on hundreds of schemes, and there are thousands in the country, and they probably all got a different set of deeds that govern them, and know that, you know, just because one set of deeds allows you to do something, another set might not, you know. So investment powers, you know, how you actually operate, how you make your decisions, you know, who has the power to cease accrual, who has the power to wind up, who has the power to give augmentations and grant early retirement, all these sorts of things. That's what we're talking about, isn't it? That's what we're talking, you know, that conversant thing. You need to know. And if you don't know, don't assume it's the same as the other scheme, or it would be this, wouldn't it? Not necessarily so. You know, every scheme has a slightly little quirk with the way they work. And if you don't do that correctly, then again, you could be making bad decisions or breach of trust, which would be an absolute disaster. You know, that's the kind of the worst position that anybody wants to be in.
Yeah, I totally right. And I think in the past, and possibly even still now, almost trustee training is viewed as a bit like an A-level. You do it, you pass it, job done. It's not really. Trusteeship these days, more and more, is almost like a part-time job. It's a vocation. You have to live through it. You can't take an exam and think, well, that's me done. It's always learning.
Well, it's funny you say a part-time job. So for some people, it's their full-time job, Chris.
Well, I think. Yeah.
That's quite an industry. Which brings me on to my next question quite nicely. That's an excellent segue for me. Thank you for that. So I think we may not have been completely explicit, but I think everything we've been talking about so far is really for people that, like you say, Chris, are people doing this in conjunction with their day job. They're doing this because they've been a member nominated trustee, easy for you to say, or been nominated by the employer to sit on a board of, you know, and work as a trustee. So professional trustees, I'm assuming they have the same, I'll do requirement in speech marks, the same requirement on them, but I suppose it's a requirement plus.
Clearly all the same requirements of any trustee are shouldered by a professional trustee, but there's a higher bar. In fact, it goes far to say there's a much higher bar. The regulator encourages, I think surprisingly doesn't mandate, but encourages accreditation. And actually, I say surprisingly, most certainly big independent trustees, professional trustees, are obtaining these accreditations these days. So perhaps the mandation isn't needed. They have to follow that. There's also the regulator's standards for professional trustees of occupational pension schemes, which set out all the standards that they expect professional trustees to meet. And I think in some ways, a professional trustee is part advisor, part trustee. It's not, and not in some ways could be a conflict of interest, but not really. Their role is to guide the rest of the trustee board, particularly if it's the rest of the trustee board, the lay trustee board, through this sort of minefield. Now, where they are the chair, they also have to meet all the roles and qualities expected of a chair. And Dave, you mentioned it earlier about the chair. And I think, interestingly, the regulator doesn't expect a higher standard of knowledge from the chair, but through good practice, the chair needs to be able to demonstrate a number of sort of softer skills and behaviours. It's an interesting debate as to whether the chair should be kept to a higher standard or not. In my view, because I think there are some ways. So the DC scheme governance in particular requires the chair to sign a number of documents. The ORA for all schemes will need to be signed by the chair. So arguably the inference being that the chair has knowledge of everything and probably ideally would be a professional if there was a professional involved. But I think we've all have trustee boards where the chair, if there is one, might excel at some of the softer skills, but might not be quite as knowledgeable on pensions and the scheme as someone else. But you certainly wouldn't want to lose that individual because of their softer skills and the way they can lead a trustee board. I think it's an interesting debate there between the two. I think more and more we're seeing professional trustees, and it is a good thing, I think, in many ways. But there are differences between the two, clearly. To some schemes, professional trustees are vital because there just isn't that knowledge. And unfortunately, that knowledge doesn't exist sometimes in the population for some trustee boards. But some, whether through luck or good appointment, can bring the right knowledge at the right time. I mean, I've one of my trustee boards, for example, a few years ago, their professional representative, a new one came on board. They had a legal background. It just happened to be at the time that we discovered a normal retirement age equalisation issue. We were kicking off GMP equalisation. So this person could really guide, obviously couldn't provide the professional legal advice, but could guide the rest of the board as to where perhaps to gain that legal advice and where the cost could be better spent elsewhere. And then clearly a lot of trustees will have investment knowledge and can really help with investment strategy reviews and complex investments like we're seeing these days with LDI, et cetera. So they are really vital. On the other hand, lay trustees bring a knowledge that you just can't write down in a code of practice. By their very nature, independent trustees won't necessarily have that history of the scheme. They won't. But some of the lay trustees bring so much of that to the table. They bring not just the knowledge of the scheme, the history of the scheme, but the knowledge of the membership. Some of them, most of them are members, have been members. So they have a fair idea of how members are going to react to things. I said they'll have an intimate knowledge of the history of the scheme. Another example, there's not many strangers to a buy-in these days, but that kind of history is vital when you're looking at a benefit spec. One of my recent buy-ins, the board were debating something that was always understood as a benefit, but the legal advisors had said the documents don't back it up. Luckily, one of the trustees not only knew, but was able to go into his loft, find the right correspondence, produce it, and suddenly that issue was solved.
But there's nothing else in his loft, Chris. It's just generic member communications in his loft, isn't it? It's nothing
his
else.
Own. He was a member, so it was his own member communication, not anyone else.
Got it.
So yeah, and as I said, that's a knowledge that I'm personally not completely in favour of sole trustees for every scheme. It works for some schemes, it does, but not for every scheme. Losing lay trustees for the sake of losing lay trustees is not a good thing because of the knowledge that a lot of them bring.
Yeah, absolutely. Catherine, sorry, do you want to come in there?
Yeah, I absolutely agree with that. I think the lay trustees, they know the business history as well. So they'll be able to say, oh, in 1998, the business was acquired and this is what happened to the scheme at the time. Or you'll have lost contact with a member and they'll be able to somehow magically put you in touch with the member because they've got the contacts with the membership. And as you said, Chris, they'll know how a communication is going to land and the right tone for that communication as well. So that's really, I think it's golden to have that on board. It's definitely best if you can have a blend of the independent trustee who's independent, no conflicts of interest, which is really helpful as well. They've got the industry knowledge as well, so they can, you know, see how things are done in other schemes and bring that to the table. They can have a good relationship with the employer and separate that out. But obviously the lay trustees just bring some other qualities as well. Blend of the two is ideal if you can manage it.
If you can manage it, I feel like there's something in there.
Well, no, it's just that we're losing. I fully understand why people don't want to be a lay trustee. It's an awful burden. It's a lot of work. Mm. And I'm really always really pleased when trustees agree to be M&Ts and carry on as well.
Yeah.
But I understand fully why somebody might not want to do that. So if you can get people who are engaged with it, that's fantastic.
Have you guys seen it work? Where you do get, say, a sole trustee, but have maybe a former trustee or somebody, you know, like a former HR director or somebody who knows the business and knows the people, can be there as sort of an advisor on another advisor on the side. You know, don't have those responsibilities that perhaps a trustee has. You know, they won't put people off, all that time commitment and all the rest of it. You know, Catherine, you're sort of hinting at, you know, people. I think that's an issue that I've noticed. You know, people are just getting older. That does happen. I don't know if, you know, you're both nodding again, listener. They're all both nodding. They're agreeing with me that everyone gets older. It's not controversial, I know. But I think it's just, I think for some people, you know, you come into this crucial point for a lot of schemes. And I think some people I'm just now too old to do this. You know, I'm not young, you know, they were probably already were, you know, 20, 30 years ago, towards the end of their career, quite senior with the business. Then you become a trustee. And now they've been doing it as a pensioner for a few years. It's just gone on too long now. Then you do have to get the professionals in just to see it over the line or see it out the last few years. But have you guys seen it where a former trustee or somebody has stuck around and just helped out?
You know, I haven't, but I can see how that would be really, really good way of working things, actually, if that was around. I mean, I've got my oldest trustee is well into his 80s and he's still sticking around to do it, which is amazing. Mm. But I can see there will be a point when, you know, he might step aside, but his knowledge is still so valuable. So, yeah, I think that would work really well if that was an option.
Yeah.
Again, indirectly and anecdotally, I know that it works. One of the schemes that I'm sort of on the periphery of has actually put a plan in place where there is going to be a sole independent trustee at some point, but the current trustee board are hanging around for a short time before that and after that, just to make sure that knowledge isn't completely lost. And yeah, I agree with Catherine completely that's a great thing if you've got people willing to do that.
Mm, that sounds really interesting. Yeah, let's know how that goes. Chris, okay, so just couple of things. I wanted to just to highlight, you know, you're talking about the role of the chair and professionals. I think the role of the trustee secretary should also not be underplayed in a lot of this. I mean, that's a role that all three of us do to varying degrees, me to lesser degree. That's why I'm this side of the questions. But yeah, the role of the trustee secretary is crucial in this, is the focal point. I don't know if either of you just want to bring out some of those, you know, a couple of points from both of you about what, you know, what the secretary brings.
Yeah. I think that sort of leads into sort of, I was going to talk a bit about softer skills.
Yeah.
And that can be a good way of getting those skills if you feel like you're lacking in any areas. Because I know the regulator does talk not only about knowledge, but also about this balance of skills that it wants the trustee board to have. And that can be so many different things. And, you know, I've worked with a lot of excellent chairs in particular who have just been able to create that good environment at meetings, make everyone very comfortable, be able to ask what they might think is a silly question, but they feel that they can have their views heard. And things like time management, you know, you might, you know, a good chair can make sure that the board is prioritising their time and the right things, and make sure that everything's running really smoothly in between meetings as well. So all of that organisation in between. Building relationships with the employer and with everybody involved. And all of those skills are great in the trustee board, but they're also mirrored, I think, in a trustee secretary as well. So trustee boards might want to have a trustee effectiveness review and periodically have a look at how they're running as a group. And if they find that they have got some areas where they're not as effective, maybe time management, maybe they're always finding that they're overrunning on their meeting times, things are getting overlooked. Something like a trustee secretary coming in to help them can really help ease some of those things and bring those skills, because we're used to doing it every day. So it's something that we can easily bring in and help them, especially in between meetings, I think, when, as we said, a lot of trustees have got day jobs, other things going on, but the scheme does still need to continue running. So I think we could help with that.
And I think as much as anything else, the trustee secretary is in the room, the whole of a meeting. So the actuary will come in, may not be there for the whole meeting. They might do their own training. They might talk about the valuation, et cetera, and leave. They won't necessarily get the best impression of the knowledge of the trustee board to other things. So they might go away thinking, well, they've got no idea about the investment strategy, blah, blah, blah. But the trustee secretary will know, actually, they're really clued in on the investment. So actually the questions they're asking were relevant. On the other hand, the trustee secretary might know actually the knowledge isn't quite there. So a good trustee secretary will ask questions as well of the advisors and help the trustees, particularly where there isn't a professional trustee, but sometimes where there is as well, help them to challenge the advisors, suggesting the questions that they can ask. Mm. And I think that's really important as well.
Okay, great. Guys, we're nearly at time. So I'm going to ask you just for your last top tip for any trustees listening that are wanting to keep on top of their sort of their TKU. We haven't used that acronym, but I think trustee knowledge understanding requirements. Does somebody want to go first? Who's going to go? Put your hand up if you want to go first.
I think one thing I haven't said so far is use the professionals you've got around you, because you can always ask your administrators or your consultant or whoever it is to come and give you a really short, snappy session. You know, it might not be something that's, a big project. It might be as simple as you've got to exercise the trustee discretion, maybe about a death lump sum. And you might want to take a step back and think, actually, what do we need to be considering when we do this to make an effective decision? And you might just want someone to come in for 15 minutes and say, this is what you should be doing. Manage your conflicts. Take into account these things. Disregard these things. And that sort of small, you know, short sessions can be really helpful, I think, just to build things up. So I would say use your professionals, and also maybe have a standing agenda item at meetings that's trustee training needs. Because I tend to have that on all my agendas, and it just means that it's always there, always something we think about, and it makes you think, oh, thinking ahead to the next meeting, actually, maybe it'd be really helpful to have a training session on this. So I think that would be another good thing to have if you haven't already got that.
I think I definitely echo that. Use your advisors. Don't be afraid to tell your advisors if you think some training is really dry, really boring, and you're not really learning anything. As Catherine said, sometimes the shorter, snappier training is much easier to remember, and get to use your own knowledge. Everyone's got knowledge in their own job. It may not be pensions knowledge, but I've had some really good interaction with trustees on cybersecurity, because that's part of what they were doing in their job. Some trustees come from a governance background. Governance is transferable. The pensions knowledge isn't always vital to a governance structure. So don't be afraid to use your own knowledge and to put your hand up and say, well, actually, I have some of this knowledge. I can help my fellow trustees to keep on top of it as well. But make sure your advisors, and again, this is where the secretary can come in, make sure your advisors help you, because it's up to us to make training entertaining and as relevant as possible.
Entertaining. Whatever. Whatever next, Chris. Goodness gracious me. Okay, on that bombshell, we'll have to call it time there. So on behalf of you all, I'll thank Catherine and Chris for their time and hot top tips on trusty training and knowledge and understanding. And we'll see you next time on the next episode of the broadcast. Thank you.